WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Are illegal and dangerous biolabs with Chinese links operating throughout the United States? The Speaker of the House is trying to shine a congressional spotlight on a Chinese-linked biolab that was discovered in Reedley, California. The lab was packed with vials of infectious viruses, hundreds of bioengineered mice, and thousands of gallons of biological fluids. Court documents say the lab mice were genetically engineered to catch and carry the COVID-19 virus. The Fresno County Department of Public Health also found samples of HIV, malaria, herpes, SARS, E. coli, more than 20 infectious agents total. State officials stumbled onto the lab late last year when they pursued a code violation after spotting a garden hose that was running through the abandoned property. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy wonders how many more of these labs exist in the United States.
They were doing research that wasn't allowed. My concern is to get to the bottom of what happened here, but also look as where is this happening other parts of this country as well. And I'm going to take this back to the Select Committee on China in dealing with it as well and working with the FBI.
The lab was operated by a company called Prestige Biotech. Health Department Director David Lucchini told a local news outlet that in his 30 years experience, he had never seen anything like the medical violations in this lab. Officials found more than 900 lab mice. A Prestige Biotech representative told investigators the mice were genetically engineered to spread COVID-19. Investigators also found that the lab didn't use a licensed medical waste hauler. So from last October until this March, when inspectors shut it down, Prestige Biotech got rid of its medical wastes illegally. The man identified in court documents as the president of Prestige said the company was developing diagnostic test kits. Prestige is successor to the now bankrupt Universal Meditech, Inc. Interestingly, Universal Meditech received $360,000 in California tax credits in April of 2019. When Universal filed for bankruptcy, Prestige was its largest creditor and moved Universal's assets from Fresno to Reedley. Just before that happened, a fire broke out at the Fresno location thanks to the hazardous materials housed there. Officials haven't found a California-based address for the company. Court documents say the other addresses of identified authorized agents were either empty offices or addresses in China that couldn't be verified. According to the Daily Caller, business filings reveal that both companies' executives appear to share the same names and addresses with one of the lab's Chinese pharmaceutical suppliers. None of the company's representatives took ownership of the biologics contained in the Reedley lab. Prestige Biotech is registered in Nevada, but unlicensed for business in California. Is this lab just the tip of the iceberg? Brandon Weichert, author of Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life, told the Daily Caller, "I suspect there could be dozens, maybe even hundreds, of these labs that we don't even know about." Join me to discuss today's stories is senior editor for The New American, Rebecca Terrell. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm well. I'm a little concerned. I think we're all thinking everything that has been said in this, and that being is how many more of these could possibly exist? Chances are it's not the only one. Obviously, you don't know. I don't know. But I guess we could be free to speculate. Seems Chinese linked, and it would make sense if there were probably more.
It would make sense. I think that it would be naive to say that China is not engaging actively in espionage against the United States. We know that back earlier this year in January, a Chinese spy balloon floated across the United States. And we know, too, that because of congressional investigations, that it hit all the, you know, floated over all of our strategic military, a lot of our strategic military sites, missile fields, and before it was shot down over the coastal waters of South Carolina, after it had traversed the entire continental United States. We know, too, back in April, there were two New York residents arrested in for setting up a police station, a Chinese police station here in the United States. And there's a report that says there are like 110, at least 110 of these Chinese police stations set up around the world, not in China. They're reputedly service centers where Chinese nationals can go to do things like, you know, renew their driver's licenses and things like that. But investigators are calling it a vast manhunt, people trying, China trying to repatriate and its citizens and also conduct espionage on foreign soil. So, you know, this is probably not just a one-time thing, this one lab, but we'll have to find out. The congressmen are saying that they're going to be working with the FBI, so we'll have to follow the story.
Yeah, and there was another element of it, and you had worked on this, and that being that I guess there was an application for a Fresno warehouse, right, which would be close to, I think, an airport in Yosemite, right? Do you remember reporting that?
Right. There, actually, that was the Washington Examiner noticed that. It was a reporter for the Washington Examiner. He took the time to look at the address that Prestige Biotech was interested in. And it's right next to the International Airport there in Fresno, which also houses the Air National Guard base. So that would be a very strategic location. Now you say, okay, they're looking at warehouse property. A lot of warehouse property is located next to airports, but you know, it leaves you with a bad taste in your mouth to know that we have the Chinese Communist Party involved.
Yeah. I mean, and then if I was to unleash a bioweapon onto an enemy country, you would obviously want to have these things near very highly populated areas, because obviously that's how these things spread, you know, by people and whatnot. Again, I know it's speculation, but this is what's happened. This is what happened with viruses and diseases. And we know that that China is no friend of ours. And apparently these are links. And we know from other reports that these people are not the agents authorized or connected with these lab are not being very forthcoming. Several of the reports have already said this. So it's like if they have nothing to hide and there's nothing, you know, devious going on, why wouldn't they just talk?
Well, we also have to consider, too, there's a much bigger picture here that is like the biggest elephant ever in any room. It's that there's a Chinese company owned by the Chinese Communist Party that operates the port of Los Angeles. Now, the city of Los Angeles still owns the port, but the operator is the Chinese Communist Party. They have also established dominance at, again, the Panama Canal. At either end of the Panama Canal, the canal itself is owned by Panama, but if you look at who's actually operating it and really effectively in control of it, it is the Chinese Communist Party. They actually own something like close to 100, they outright own close to 100 ports. Wow. Worldwide. So, you know, they're establishing economic dominance, but that's not the only strategic advantage here. You have to think about what are the military implications there, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to go to our next story. So thanks to a Truth Social post that he broadcast on Friday, Donald Trump has found himself in a battle he may have been able to avoid, at least for the time being. On Friday, Trump posted, "You go after me, I'm coming after you." This triggered prosecutors in the January 6th criminal case to ask that the judge impose a strict protective order, the kind Trump and his team say would essentially gag him. In case you've lost track, this is concerning the latest indictment, the one where he's accused of falsely claiming that the 2020 election was fraudulent. He's charged with conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. The prosecution team said Trump's "You Go After Me" post concerned them that he might improperly share case evidence on his social media account. Trump's campaign, however, says the post is the definition of political speech, and they added that he was talking about special interest groups, not the case. The prosecution team says a protective order is necessary to keep Trump from discussing the case. They say Trump's speech would taint potential jurors or intimidate witnesses. So late on Monday, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan said she'll order a hearing this week to go over the prosecutor's demand. So the saga continues. Here's how the liberal media is reporting this incident.
Former President Trump issues a major threat after pleading not guilty again today. That is right, twice in 24 hours, the former president pleading not guilty to federal criminal charges and writing on his social media in all caps, quote, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you. And that post was soon followed by a new Trump campaign ad naming and showing the prosecutors that Trump claims are trying to, quote, get him.
Okay, Rebecca. So I don't know where you stand on this, but I imagine that you're like one of many people and you're thinking, how much trouble could Trump have avoided in all his years here in politics if he would just learn to shut up sometimes?
Well, he's never been one. He's never been one to do that. So this shouldn't come as a surprise. I think he kind of likes to poke the bear. I don't think he's intimidated by any of this. It does seem just a kangaroo court and crazy. It was like, what else can you hesitate to ask? What else can happen? But it's insanity. Would you ever have believed that we would have gotten to this point where a former president would be raked over the coals this way? I can understand his frustration, but I don't think that he's intimidated.
No, well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell with him, but it's, I don't know what it is with the, I guess some people may admire the fact that he's fighting back, and I think that's why people like him in general, and I do as well. It's nice to see him go at it, but I think a lot of the time you would think that sometimes you got to pick and choose your battles, but he puts these things out there. But on the other side of the coin, I would also think, and this is something we've all wondered, at some point they want to gag him anyway, right? So maybe they were looking for an excuse to shut him up anyway.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm surprised that the judge didn't put a gag order on the case to begin with, right. Especially something so, you know, headlining and how where can he get a fair trial? I mean, it is a good question to ask.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just think the whole thing, they're going to get him. They've been trying and trying and trying, and they're going to keep trying until they get him.
Yeah. And there's a lot of analysts who say, look, one way or another, these people are determined. They're going to get him. And some say he'll even end up in prison. I think that, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I believe there's a Georgia indictment waiting in the wings as well. So they're going to pepper him. And are you aware of reports as well that a lot of this is draining his resources from the campaign as well? Have you heard of anything like that?
Sure. Well, I mean, that would make sense. I'm not sure the campaign would be paying for any of his legal fees. That seems like something that he would be doing privately. But, you know, any drain of resources at this point, anything that they can do to damage him, they're going to do because he's public enemy number one. And one of our main problems is the United States presidential elections have become a popularity contest. And we don't need Mr. Popularity. We do need a good businessman, a constitutionalist who knows what our country needs, not spoon feeding the nanny state that we've created. Yeah. You know, we need another Calvin Coolidge. We don't need the smiling Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and all that.
Yesterday, we ran a story about how John Bolton, I think, said last week to The Hill, how Trump would be dangerous for foreign. And of course, John Bolton worked for Trump, and he said he'd be dangerous for America. And one of the reasons he listed is because he might want to get us out of NATO. So this is what it comes down to, isn't it? The globalists want this man away because he's going to push back on their globalist agenda.
Well, and he didn't even hit as hard as he possibly could have. There were a lot of things that he did during his administration that I didn't like. But that doesn't mean that I don't think there were some things he did that were great, you know, getting us out of involvement in various UN organizations, doing what he could, you know, mm-hmm. to get us to, yes, make America great again, focusing on America. But, you know, then again, COVID hit and he was pushing the vaccines too. So I'm not this big, you know, Trump is the hero. Trump is the savior of us all. No, we actually need to get the country back to where we don't really pay that much attention to the federal government. The federal mm-hmm. government should be small. Back in the early days of this country, people didn't even really know who the president was. We need to be focusing on our local level, on our state level, and get our minds off of all this. It's like a reality show. You know, you turn on the TV, turn the TV off. Don't get any of your information from major media. You're going to get lied to. You're going to get indoctrinated and brainwashed.
And you bring up an interesting point, because I think there are a lot of Americans, especially today, where they do see the presidency as like the hinge that everything that everything is attached to. And you're right. I think we certainly need to get away from that, but we also need to get back to get more states power, right? People need to realize that the power that their states have. Here at the John Birch Society, of course, we've focused a lot on nullification, that being that when the federal government issues unconstitutional orders, the states have an obligation to nullify those. So, all right.
And not only the states, but even your county sheriff, he has the right and the duty to say, not on my watch. That's not happening here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw some of that with COVID. I was blessed to live in two counties where the county sheriffs did say things like, we're not the mask police. And that was just one example. Obviously, we wish they would have all gone a little further and to completely nullify. But I mean, I lived in the county where certain bars didn't close or whatnot because they knew that there was no teeth to it. And that they knew that because the sheriff has decided this is not going to be, we're not going to waste our time being the mask police or anything like that. And so we need to get back to that. You're absolutely right. Thanks, Rebecca. Well, hey, folks, have you made plans to attend the John Birch Society's Leadership Conference this September? If not, you should. This year, we'll be gathering in Des Moines, Iowa, and we'll be discussing effective strategies you can use in your activism. We'll also bring plenty of materials that you can take back home with you. This will be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet other like-minded patriots. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, whose discussion topic will be the death of science, medical freedom in an era of lies. James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, he'll also be there. And on Friday, we'll be doing dinner and watching his movie. Former Iowa U.S. Congressman Steve King will join us as well, as will renowned physicist and election expert Dr. Douglas Frank. The New American's Alex Newman, he'll be there as well, and he'll be talking about how climate change is used to scare and control people. And that's just a very brief summary of everything that we'll be discussing and doing over those 2 days. You can learn more and get your conference tickets at jbs.org. Or if you prefer, you can call for him at 1-800-527-8721. But hurry up before the ticket window closes. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or by calling 1-800-527-8721. And stay tuned, because after this, we're going to look at another way pro-lifers are trying to help people who can't take care of their babies. We'll be right back.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. Since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year, the media has been freaking out about what they call extra births. Here at The New American, where sanity still prevails, we refer to babies not being murdered in the womb as lives saved. The Atlantic primed us for this narrative last December when it published a story with the headline, "We are not prepared for the coming surge of babies." Last year, Mississippi's Department of Child Protective Services commissioner testified before the state Senate that her agency was not ready for 5,000 annual births. And this June, the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, published research targeting Texas, which, like Mississippi, bans most abortions with very limited exceptions. The JAMA analysis suggests that Texas's anti-abortion law has saved nearly 9,800 children. The mainstream narrative denigrates priceless human beings to economic burdens, and it ignores the 3,000-plus pregnancy resource centers nationwide. Also known as crisis pregnancy centers, they are community-based, not-for-profit organizations established to provide care and resources for pregnant women who need them. The pro-death narrative also ignores the reality that every state has safe haven laws. These laws protect from prosecution those who want to give up their newborns. Rules vary from state to state, but in general, they allow a parent or legal guardian to walk into a designated safe haven location, such as a fire station or hospital, and turn an unharmed newborn over to a staff member. Under these conditions, the adult will not face charges of abandonment, neglect, or child endangerment. The National Safe Haven Alliance reports that these laws have saved more than 4,000 lives since 1999, and the group offers a 24-hour hotline for those who need further help. However, safe haven laws don't protect people who abandon children on the doorsteps. Nevertheless, abandonment still happens, and for that reason, Monica Kelsey founded the nonprofit Safe Haven Baby Boxes after learning that she herself was abandoned as an infant. The boxes take face-to-face interaction out of the surrender process and protect the mother's anonymity. Here's Kelsey explaining how the system works.
She's going to walk directly up to the box. She's going to pull the little handle. She's going to open up the door. As soon as this door is opened up, one of the alarms is already going off. It's a silent alarm that mom will not hear. When she places baby inside the box, another alarm goes off that she will not hear. When she shuts the door, she won't be able to reopen the door. The door actually locks once baby's placed inside. The baby can only be retrieved from the inside of the fire station, or in this case, the inside of the hospital. Inside, you'll see a green light that is always green if there is no baby in our box. Once there's a baby placed in our box, you'll see a green plus a yellow orangish light because the beam from across has been broken. After mom places her baby in one of our Safe Haven baby boxes, one of the staff or the EMTs or the paramedics or the nurses will come down to the baby box. They're going to open the inside door. They're going to grab the bassinet. And they're going to head for the emergency room.
Last week, Kentucky's ABC News affiliate WKO reported that the second newborn within the past 6 months was surrendered to the same Safe Haven baby box at the Bowling Green Fire Department. The infant is healthy and is the third to be surrendered to a baby box in the state this year, the 13th nationally. One of those was a little girl put in Florida's only Safe Haven baby box at a fire station in Ocala on January 2nd. The firefighter who retrieved her is now her proud father. He told his story to NBC News.
I opened the box and there she is. I picked her up. She wasn't crying. As soon as we locked eyes, that was it. I was in love with her.
He took the infant to the emergency room with a note pinned to her blanket that he and his wife wanted to adopt her. They were already registered to adopt in the state. 2 days later, they took her home from the hospital. And in April, the adoption was finalized. They've concealed their last name in news reports for privacy reasons, but Vincent and Katie want their story told so Zoe's birth mother knows how grateful they are and that her daughter is safe and loved. There are 153 Safe Haven baby boxes across the country, and Kelsey says they have helped save more than 130 children since the first was installed in 2016. However, not everyone's excited about these baby boxes. A group called Stop Baby Boxes Now argues that they deny the rights of the non-surrendering parent, create at-risk adoptions, and potentially hide crimes such as rape and incest. There's also grave concern that the anonymity of these surrenders could add to the problem of child trafficking. Writing in opposition to an Indiana state bill authorizing baby boxes and absenting them from stricter rules that apply to traditional safe haven surrenders, attorney Greg Luce points out that adoption is unequivocally a multi-billion dollar industry that prizes infants above all other children for placement. Agencies charge upwards of $50,000 or more for an infant adoption. For these reasons, corruption in adoption has always been an issue, whether in cutting regulatory corners, paying facilitators or middlemen for placements or tips, or ignoring basic protections for vulnerable parents and their children. He says the Indiana bill creates a genuine recipe for increasing adoption corruption in the state and is one of the worst child welfare bills I have seen in some time. Okay, Rebecca, what is your take on this Indiana bill?
Well, I have to say that I believe he raises some interesting points, some valid points. What he's talking about in that Indiana bill is with a normal safe haven surrender, a person walks into a facility and actually has to have interaction with a staff member. In this case, there's no interaction. However, what this bill does is it takes away more than just that, allows more than just that total anonymity. It takes away any requirement that that staff member report to, for instance, the Department of Child Services. The staff member can decide what he or she wants to do at that point, if they want to just contact a private adoption agency. And so you can see how that does open the door for potential child trafficking. We do have to acknowledge that child trafficking has taken place in this country before through adoption agencies. I'm not demonizing adoption agencies by any stretch of the imagination, because most are reputable. It's always the few bad seeds that spoil the bunch, right? But there are problems with it. There are difficulties because the state laws are changing regarding these baby boxes, taking away safeguards that mm-hmm. protect that child from going into the wrong, you know, down the wrong path.
You know, what I find interesting is this narrative that we can't support more children in America. And here we are funneling billions of dollars overseas for so many other projects. And they're trying to tell us we can't support more babies. We can't allow more humans.
The quote from Mississippi saying, oh, we can't handle the 5,000 extra births that are going to happen. Well, just prior to Roe v. Wade getting overturned, the Guttmacher Institute, which is the research arm of Planned Parenthood, said that there were 2,500 abortions every year in Mississippi, and not all of those were Mississippi residents. So where do the extra 2,500 come from? Are these inflated numbers? I question the numbers that they're using. And another thing about these baby boxes, they are acclaimed in major media, where the pregnancy resource centers are poo-pooed. We know the FBI has turned a blind eye to the attacks on pregnancy resource centers. So that's another kind of red flag that we have to think about.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. Thanks for joining us. Well, thanks, folks. And we'll be back with more New American TV.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
Next up, The New American's Christian Gomez interviews Congressman Glenn Grofman, chairman of the House Subcommittee hearing on Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena. Christian asked the Wisconsin congressman about whether UAPs or UFOs constitute a threat to U.S. national security, what they might be, and where they may come from. Let's listen.
This is Christian Gomez for The New American Magazine, and on the program today, we'll be speaking with Congressman Glenn Grofman of Wisconsin, who was the chairman of the subcommittee hearing about UAPs or UFOs. Congressman Grofman, thank you so much for joining us today here on the program.
Honored to be on the show.
Well, thank you. So, Congressman, do you believe that UAPs or unidentified anomalous phenomena or UFOs constitute a threat to U.S. national security?
Well, we don't know what they are. At the hearing, if you listen to it, there were two naval pilots who both, not just themselves, but them and other members of their squadron, saw two separate types of what we used to call unidentified flying objects. Some saw gigantic Tic Tac, like the Breathman, things shaped like that that were flying along, and others saw spherical, clear spherical things with a big black box in them. So I'm going to do some follow-up interview with both those guys and another person who apparently was involved in keeping track of this sort of thing for the government in the past, and see what I find out. We had three witnesses there. In addition to the people who saw UFOs, there was another witness who kept saying he could not testify publicly, implying that he could tell us stuff privately. I'll be talking to that guy in September. We'll see what more I can find out.
So of the three witnesses who testified before the subcommittee, what are your thoughts about former Air Force Intelligence Officer David Grosch, if I'm saying his name correctly?
Well, and his... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, specifically, what are your thoughts about his bombshell testimony that the U.S. government supposedly or allegedly has a multi-decade UAP crash retrieval and reverse engineering program? Do you believe that to be the case?
Well, he kept saying he couldn't talk about things publicly. He's the one I have to talk about privately. He claims that we recovered non-human life aboard one of these things that crashed. I do not understand why we would be keeping any of this stuff top secret, say, from 20 years ago. And, you know, they've made a big deal out of these UFOs even in the 1960s, the early 70s. There were people reported seeing things, both Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. Reported seeing UFOs. I don't know why stuff from that era cannot immediately be released. And I don't know why we don't have a more thorough investigation of what both of these naval pilots saw.
And I believe Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter were both in the United States Navy as well, before they became presidents, of course.
Right. I think Jimmy Carter saw this before he was famous.
On Fox News, your colleague on the subcommittee, Republican Congressman Tim Burchett of Tennessee, said that the only way we're going to get to the bottom about UAPs is with a select committee on the issue. And likewise, a Democrat Congressman, Jared Moskowitz of Florida, who's also on the same subcommittee hearing as you, he tweeted the following: "I fully support the idea of the creation of a select committee on UAP with subpoena power." Congressman Grothman, do you agree with both Congressman Burchett and Congressman Moskowitz that there should be a select committee that has subpoena power to really get to the bottom about the UAPs?
Well, that would be up to Kevin McCarthy. The subcommittee that we have, or the Committee on Oversight, we also have subpoena power. So right now, I don't see a reason to set up a separate committee. But who knows what Kevin McCarthy will decide in the future. I thought we had a very productive committee hearing. I think we're going to do some closed-door stuff in September from two or three more witnesses, and then we can go from there as to whether or not we should have another full hearing.
When Ranking Member Raskin asked Mr. Grosch what kind of reception he had been receiving, Mr. Grosch said that he had knowledge of active planned reprisal activity against him. And Congressman Raskin reassured him that there would be bipartisan rejection of any kind of reprisals made against him. So, Congressman Grothman, I ask you, as the chairman of that subcommittee, what would bipartisan rejection of reprisals against him or any other witnesses look like? What would you or Congress as a whole do to protect these witnesses?
Well, I don't think we have any specific plans because I don't know whether something like that would happen. I would be surprised if something like that would happen. I do think we as a committee will eventually do what we can to get a hold of things, like I said, 15 or 20 years ago. And quite frankly, I had a rather bizarre fascination with UFOs when I was in middle school. So I read books about it at that time. And it kind of, nothing has changed. Okay, we still are having military pilots and some commercial pilots claim they see things. We still say that the government is hiding this stuff. We still say it's hidden because of national security reasons. I cannot imagine why our government at this time would not release all of this information at least 20 years ago so the American public could see whether there is or is not an innocent explanation for this. And of course we would do all we can to protect anybody that the military would go after. I don't know what form that would be, particularly if we're asking them to testify in public.
David Grosz, the former intelligence officer, with him being a former intelligence officer, I sort of feel that one can never be too sure whether to trust individuals who come from that area, because here's a thought here that I want to ask you, Congressman. What are your thoughts that of the possibility that perhaps his testimony was part of a larger black ops intelligence effort intended to convince the American people and the world that UAPs and UFOs are real, when they're probably maybe super advanced, highly classified U.S. aircraft, and that the U.S. is trying to project the image to Russia and China and our adversaries? We don't know what they are, so then the Russians and Chinese don't suspect that they're ours when they may be ours. What are your thoughts that that could actually be the case?
Well, that's one of the things you think about. And part of it is I'd like to nail down exactly how common these sightings are. I felt in the hearing of the three witnesses we had, the two most illuminating were the ones who actually saw this sort of thing and saw these UFOs or UAPs doing maneuvers that a normal aircraft could not do, right? Stopping quickly, starting quickly, going up, going down, that sort of thing. So I'd like to talk to other pilots who saw the same thing, and we're going to see what Mr. Grosz has to say in a closed-door setting. It was very frustrating during the committee because he kept saying, I can't say this now, I can't say this now. He didn't tell us why he couldn't say it now, but we're going to find out what he says behind closed doors, as well as another person who's come forward says that the intelligence community is sitting on sightings that happened 10 or 20 years ago. I have talked to him on the phone, and we're going to have maybe a closed-door meeting with him as well.
Now, I would be curious to see if other countries what other countries know about UAPs and UFOs, specifically non-NATO countries such as Russia and China or the republics of even the former Soviet Union, to see if their reports of UFOs and UAPs corroborate the accounts of ours. Because my thought is, Congressman, that if they don't corroborate, for example, in Arizona, there was the incident of the Arizona Lights, the black triangular craft that supposedly it was seen by many that flew over Las Vegas around 1994. And in Belgium in 1993, there was a sighting of a black triangular craft. Of course, these happen in NATO countries. So you wonder, is that a U.S. aircraft, like a stealth bomber, that's highly classified? How come there haven't been any of these black triangle sightings in, say, deep in Russia? Could it be because if it's really ours, we would never dare test it over in a potential adversary country? So what are your thoughts on looking into UFO reports from other nations outside of the U.S. and its allies to see if there's any commonalities or differences?
Well, I agree with you. I think one of the things that's suspicious is not just recently, but going back 50 years. It seems like this sort of thing is always happening in the United States, right? We never have sightings over the Congo or, you know, sightings over Laos. It always just miraculously is American pilots in American airspace, or like you said, over NATO countries. And it does raise a question, right? If people are coming here from outer space, why are they only interested in the United States? So it's one of the questions I'll be asking.
In an article on News Nation, Mr. Grosz, again, was quoted as saying, as somebody who has studied physics, where, you know, maybe they're coming from a different physical dimension as described in quantum mechanics, we know there are extra dimensions due to high energy particle collisions, etc. And there's a theoretical framework to explain that. And also during the hearing, he also again hinted at the possibility of an extra dimensional origin for whatever, whoever the occupants of these craft or whatever they are, which leads me to my next question. Many Christians, especially evangelical Christians, believe or have said that what people think are aliens perhaps are not really aliens, but could instead be demons or some kind of creatures of demonic origin. What are your thoughts that these may not be from another world far away, but that they could be demonic creatures that are malevolent and duplicitous?
Well, I've never considered that before, so I'll see what Mr. Gresh has to say to that when I meet him. That has never occurred to me before. Obviously, there's some things out there that we don't understand. These are, you know, well-respected naval pilots. They did not see this stuff alone. In each case, a variety of other pilots saw the same thing. So, you know, who knows what the explanation could be.
And what are some steps that you'd like to see Congress take next? You mentioned there's going to be the closed door sessions with him and other witnesses, perhaps in September. But what would you like to see Congress do next, whether it's this year or even next year, with regards to UAPs?
Take steps to make sure all this stuff is made public. If there is a possible national security reason why we don't want to make something that happened 3 years ago public, all of this argument or discussion was being had 50 years ago. So let's make public what happened in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And I think that will put some of these questions to rest.
Sounds good.
At this juncture in the interview, Christian Gomez switches gears from asking Congressman Grofman about unknown extraterrestrial to asking him about the undeniable illegal aliens who are crossing America's southern border. We'll play the rest of the Grofman interview tomorrow, but for right now, we're going to go to another interview about the importance of each state keeping a Republican form of government on the other side of this short break.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
What good is a constitution limiting the whims and passions of the majority if it can be changed by a simple majority vote? But that's exactly the case in many of the states, including in Ohio, where today, August 8, the voters are deciding on a ballot question to raise the threshold from changing the Ohio state constitution from a simple majority vote to a 60% supermajority. Ohio citizens who want the higher threshold fear that with a massive expenditure of money, the people could be beguiled into voting to change the state constitution to make abortion legal right up until birth. So next up, Christian Gomez interviews fellow John Birch Society researcher Peter Rykowski about Ohio's ballot question. The interview was recorded several days ago, but it's being broadcast today, August 8, the day of the vote. Even if you don't live in Ohio, you'll want to listen since the principles of republicanism versus unrestrained majority rule are applicable to all of the states.
This is Christian Gomez for the New American Magazine, and I'm joined today again with Peter Rykowski, our research associate. Peter, thank you so much for joining us again today.
It's great to be on, Christian.
So today we're discussing a ballot measure that's in the state of Ohio, specifically one that would require 60% of voters to approve a constitutional amendment, because right now, as it currently stands, 50% of voters can approve a change to the state's constitution if there's a referendum for that. Now, we discussed this before on the program. What's the difference between what we discussed before and what's happened now?
Yeah, so when we discussed this on the program a few months ago, this was still a resolution of the state legislature because there was an effort in the Ohio legislature to put this on the ballot. In Ohio, there are two ways to place constitutional amendments on the ballot. One is through some citizens' initiative process where people can just collect signatures and then put an amendment on the ballot. And the state legislator can also put things on the ballot. So this is one of them. So this effort to put this question on the ballot succeeded. So now Ohio voters will be voting on this on August 8th. And this is a very important issue, as you mentioned. It would change the Constitution to require any future state constitutional amendments to pass with a 60% majority rather than a 50% majority. And right now, in most states, it only requires a simple majority for any amendment to the state constitution to be enacted. And in many of those states, they have those citizens' initiative processes where the state legislator doesn't even get involved. So it's really easy, in fact, way too easy, to change a state constitution, the fundamental document of a state, and very easy to change it, which leads to all these radical, ridiculous, extremist amendments from getting passed in the various states.
Absolutely. Of course, when you go to the ballot, when you see the referendum question, it's usually a small sentence, and it's usually written by those who want the change. So it's written in a way where it leads the reader and the voter to be supportive of it because of the way of how they worded it. And there's usually no contrary information or even more information. There's just a one little question with a little brief description and yes or no. So it's really important to increase the threshold from 50 to 60. But you know, in this age of democracy, because that's what we're always hearing, the left, especially the left, but even some Republicans talk about the importance of saving our democracy, protecting our democracy. Even Fox News in their election coverage, they call it Democracy 2024, Democracy 2020, Democracy 2016. That's what they keep referring to our form of government as. So in terms of democracy and republic and forms of government, what is the significance of this change? Why should voters agree to make it harder to change their state's constitution?
Yeah, this ballot measure is really important because it would put Ohio on the path towards restoring a Republican form of government and going away from a Democratic form of government. Our country, both the federal government and also the various states, are not democracies. They're not supposed to be democracies. The Founding Fathers did not want our federal government or the state governments to be democracies. They designed them to be constitutional republics. And there's a huge difference between that. In democracy, there's majority rule, tyranny of the majority. If 51% of the people want something, then no matter how radical it is, no matter how much it violates God-given freedoms, whatever that proposal is, it can pass. A constitutional republic upholds God-given freedoms, which, because God does not change, those freedoms don't change either. So there are some things in a constitutional republic where a majority of the people cannot change or affect. So it's really important that we continue upholding and protecting constitutional rights, or God-given rights, I should say, regardless of what the majority of the people think. And then also I would add that Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution also guarantees that each state has a Republican form of government. So this is, not only just common sense, how to uphold freedom, but it's also in the U.S. Constitution that each state should have a Republican form of government, not a Democratic form of government. The U.S. Constitution does not refer to the term or word democracy anywhere, and for very good reason. So this ballot measure is really important for upholding a Republican form of government and, taking Ohio away from, a tyranny of the majority type of system.
You know, most people may not realize this, but when it comes to our federal U.S. Constitution, most do recognize the fact that our Constitution has remained the same with the exception of the addition of the 27 amendments in total, but it's the same Constitution nevertheless that came out of the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and that was ratified by the states and approved by Congress, affirming the ratification of the states. So our Constitution it's considered the world's longest and oldest, still standing, still serving, active Constitution. But that's not true when it comes to many of the states. Many of the states, from the moment they became a state to now, a lot of states have had different constitutions where they've changed their constitution or adopted a whole new one completely. So when it comes to Ohio having the requirement of 50%, that wasn't always the case, I'm assuming, since the beginning of the state of Ohio. This was probably a more recent change to make it more democratic. And now this is an effort to go back to the founding principles of Republican state government as guaranteed by Article 4, Section 4, correct?
Right. In fact, when our country was founded, these ballot measures, these ballot initiatives, they weren't even a thing. It was not normal or common for people to vote on constitutional amendments to the state constitution, and especially not 50% of the people voting on these very far-reaching, very radical types of amendments. In fact, much of this happened later in the late 1800s and throughout the 1900s as people started promoting the notion of democracy.
And that was part of the progressive movement, William Jennings Bryan and Theodore Roosevelt, that kind of that era of American history.
Right. Yeah, in fact, this is very interesting. Many of the New England states, even though they're some of the most left-wing states today, there's still the vestiges of the principles and values of when our country was founded. And those constitutions are actually the most restrictive when it comes to referendums and ballot measures. Even today, a referendum can only happen if the state legislator specifically decides to put it on the ballot. And in some cases, if the state legislator it needs to vote on it more than one session in a row. So it's very interesting how that is. So this is a recent development. And as you mentioned, many of these state constitutions now are very, very poor, or in very poor shape, very poor quality.
So what you could say that the state constitutions are basically a product of the geography and history from which they became a state. You look at a state like California, a western state, became a state in the 1840s. Same thing with Wisconsin, became a state also around the 1840s or so. And these are states that are heavily influenced by populism, and they tend to be historically more liberal than not. But you have states like, let's say, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut. These are states that they were part of the beginnings of American history, and their constitutions are reflective of the time from which they were written, notwithstanding perhaps any more recent amendments to those states' constitutions. Okay, so Peter, my final question for today: what is the importance of having a 60% threshold versus a 50%? Like, why does it really matter?
Yeah, well, practically, there's a huge difference. We talked about the principle at first. You know, why on a principled basis it should be harder to amend the Constitution. Why we should not promote or accept ideas of democracy, but practically it's also very important. So for example, Florida is actually the only state that has a 60% threshold. Colorado has 55%, but Florida is the only one with 60%. And there have been several referendums in the past few years that would have passed, that would have enacted some very damaging provisions in the state constitution, but they failed because of the 60% provision. So one of them actually just in 2020 would have established a California-style political primary system where Republicans and Democrats run on the same ballot and then voters vote for pretty much the whole thing, Democrat, Republican, the primary election, just all on one ballot on election day in November and then with a runoff all the way in December. So this referendum is on the Florida ballot, and this is dangerous, just to briefly go over this, because in California, they have the system, and in many elections, even in districts that are majority Republican, the two nominees are oftentimes both Democrats, because there are only a couple of Democrats on the ballot, they spend a lot more money, there are 10 Republicans on the same ballot, so the vote is divided, so various reasons because of that. So it's really a benefit for far-left politicians. This actually received 57% of the popular vote, this referendum in Florida, but it failed because in Florida it required 60%. So this is why having a 60% threshold is very important. Then I'll also add, in Ohio in November, there will be another referendum on essentially legalizing abortion up to the moment of birth.
Wow.
So if this referendum in August, if it fails, 51% of Ohioans could vote to essentially allow preborn babies to be murdered up until the moment of birth, and that referendum will be, that question will be put into the state constitution. So having, you know, so making it harder to amend a state constitution is very important in every person, regardless of whether they're in Ohio, voting for this measure, or even if they're in another state, they should be telling their legislators to put something like this on the ballot, make it harder to amend the Constitution, restore a Republican form of government, and go away from democracy, which is just another term for tyranny of the majority.
Well said, Peter. Thank you so much for the discussion today.
If you're a voter in Ohio and have not cast your vote yet, we encourage you to do so today prior to the polls closing. Well, thank you, folks, for tuning in to another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good rest of the day, and we'll see you tomorrow.